It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now we continue our series, Leaving Afghanistan, after 2 decades. All U.S. troops leaving that war-torn country. America's longest war has dramatically reshaped the geopolitics of that region. It's also dramatically altered the lives of Americans who served there. The goal of our River to River series, Leaving Afghanistan, is to understand a personal dimension of the war by focusing on the individual experiences of Iowans who've done all types of work in Afghanistan over the last 20 years. And we've been hearing a number of these interviews in the past few weeks. We want to thank all our veterans for their service and for sharing their experiences with IPR listeners. You can listen to all the interviews in this series, enjoy photos that our vets have sent us, and find out more about the series by going to iowapublicradio.org/leavingafghanistan. That's iowapublicradio.org/leavingafghanistan. Perhaps you served in Afghanistan as well and like to share your story on IPR. You can let us know about that at our email address, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. When you write us an email at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, please mention where you grew up in Iowa, when you were deployed, your branch of the military, your rank, as well as a memory or two that you'll never forget from your time in Afghanistan. My guest today is a resident of Davenport. Maria Berdicia is a Navy veteran of Afghanistan, originally from Texas, who now lives in Davenport. Maria, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, welcome. Thank you for your service, of course. You've been retired from the military for some 14 years, I understand. Start off by telling us more about yourself and the nature of your service in the Navy as an aviation mechanic.
Sure. I was born in a small town in Texas a long time ago. But after high school, I didn't really have direction of where to go, and I didn't really have a lot of mentors or just any type of support that, you know, guided me or anything. So I went and I talked to the Navy recruiter, and he was going over different jobs, and he said aviation, he could work as an electrician, as a mechanic, you know, kind of give me a rundown. And I took the practice ASVAB, and I scored pretty high. But once I went to the MEPS building, I failed it. I don't know if it was nerves. So I got on the phone with him and I told him what happened. And he was telling me, okay, let me see what I can do. So he had me go back to retake it. And I was then sent to Great Lakes in 97.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is before 9/11, you became an aviation mechanic. Take us back, because your deployment, I understand, began in the Middle East, in that area, began before 9/11. Tell us about the first time you were deployed to the Middle East, where you were, and what your mission was there.
So my first deployment was in 98, and it was to the same area. We were deployed to Diego Garcia, and then from there we had different dead sites. And one of them was Bahrain and another one, Nasiriyah. And we did, we were involved in like medevacs, and then we did a lot of exercises with other commands, and then we relieved the command. So every time, every 6 months, we were rotating to that area. So like I said, we were involved with medevacs and then other stuff there. That was my first deployment in 98. And then the second deployment was to Japan, but then the third and fourth deployment were back to the Middle East.
So tell me a little bit, I just don't know what the life of the daily routine of an aviation mechanic in the Navy would be like. Tell us what your days were like, what your job consisted of.
Well, on deployment, everything changes. You don't work, you know, 9 to 5. You work 12 on, 12 off. Until the deployment's over. So we would start the day by prepping the planes to make sure they're fueled. They were inspected to make sure they were ready to fly. because, you know, they did missions. And we launched them. And around, I would say, 1 o'clock, we would recover the planes, make sure that they were fueled, made sure that everything was still intact, that they didn't need any maintenance. And that went on. And if the plane needed maintenance to be done, then we just stayed there until everything was done. So sometimes a 12-hour day would turn into an 18, 20-hour day.
Wow. And so I get the feeling you're, in some cases, in deployment, under time pressure. Also the time pressure, and you know, as an aviation mechanic, that the lives of the air crew could depend on you if you did the maintenance correctly, right? Is that something that's always on your mind in your position?
Oh, yes, definitely. There was a time that a plane came in and it had part of the turbine blades that were missing. You know, and then we did a thorough inspection. They were not there, but yeah, that's always on your mind. You want to make sure you do the best because, you know, there's lives. You're responsible for those lives, essentially.
I imagine a meticulous attention to detail when you're doing that maintenance is something you absolutely have to have.
Yes. You lose, like, a bolt or any little thing. It can go in the engine. And not to mention, you know, the how much the engine are worth. And then the plane is down for a few weeks. And, you know, there's lots of mission hours, flight hours. And then you're still down. You know, the plane's still down. So you got to fix it.
Yeah. So you entered the military in 1997, your first deployment, I think you said in 1998. Tell us what the military was like back then, because that's more than 20 years ago. We've been seeing in our news a lot of, you know, reforms, much-needed reforms in the military. Did you encounter any of the problematic side of the military that's been, well, been addressed in recent years?
When I came in, there wasn't that many female mechanics. I mean, it was really male-dominated. So I was told I didn't belong in the Navy. Women didn't belong in the military. Women belonged in the office or in the kitchen. You know, just stuff like that. I was harassed. I got into a few altercations. Just because, you know, it was just so tough to just hold back. So I think going in, I was very naive. I didn't know, I was very naive about everything. And then just getting there and getting to know how people were or their thoughts, or especially the males, it was really hard. So I kind of had to grow a thick skin, I should say. And
yeah.
I had to prove myself every day, for sure.
Sorry to hear you had to experience that, but good that our military is, at least by appearance, is changing its culture in that way. Tell us,
yes,
Maria, about the deployment after 9/11 when you went back to the Middle East.
So during 9/11, we were deployed. So when we deployed, we really weren't expecting anything to happen. It was just like a routine deployment. You know, we've done this. Well, that was my third time now.
Where were you?
I was in Misira. It's a small island, 2 hours flight time from Afghanistan and 2 hours flight time from Bahrain. So it was just mostly like a site where planes would come in. They would fuel. If they needed any little thing done, they would get it done and then take off, basically. Like a little pit stop.
And so on 9/11, you're at this small island in the Middle East. And how do you find out that the U.S. had been attacked on 9/11?
Well, that day, it was just any other day. We were recovering planes. I was doing my last-minute things, and one of the guys came out, and he said, "Hey, you need it inside." And I was like, "Okay, I'll go in there in a minute." And then they sent, like, a couple minutes later, they sent somebody else. And I was like, "I'll be there. I'm almost done." And then the third time, my senior chief came out in the truck, and he said, "You need to be inside now." And I'm like, "Okay, it's probably serious." So I went in the office, and everybody's standing there watching the news. I thought they were watching a movie. And all of a sudden, like, you see the planes being hit, and you see people jumping out of the Twin Towers. And at first, I don't know if my mind wasn't registering, but I was just kind of like, you call me in to watch a movie? You know, like, I could have been done with my work. But they kept playing it over and over again, and I felt like my mind was just rejecting that, because to me, it didn't make sense. From that point on, they called the town hall meeting. And I can remember the workers there. I can remember us. Like, you could hear a pin drop. And everybody was in shock. We could not believe that this had happened to the U.S. Never in my wildest dreams did I think that I was going to see that. So we were told, essentially, since we were there basically already, and we had been training for all of this, that, you know, our jobs were going to change. From that point on, we started ordering body bags, and we started just getting ready for casualties.
Let me just mention, for those who may have just joined us, talking with Maria Berdicia, Navy veteran of Afghanistan, as part of our Leaving Afghanistan series. So it sounds like on 9/11, soon after, your military base on that little island in the Middle East, just a couple hour flight hours away from Afghanistan, changed very quickly. What kind of activity did you witness on the island happening there?
Well, at the time, like, we went from being able to have two planes in one fueling to we only had access to where we worked and where we slept, basically. From that point, like, within, I would say, hours, not even a full day, there was already Air Force coming in, Army, Special Forces, British Army was there, and it was just chaotic. They started building, we called it Tent City, because it was all kinds of tents everywhere you looked.
I understand that when the Pentagon got hit, you found out that one of your officers was killed?
Yes, sir. He had just transferred to the Pentagon, and he was one of the casualties.
It must have been very scary to be outside the country, to hear of this news, our country under attack on 9/11, and then to hear that one of your officers had been killed at the Pentagon. What do you recall about your thoughts in the immediate aftermath of 9/11?
My thoughts were just to be ready at all times, you know, to be as sharp as I could, because, you know, the planes needed to be flying. So I needed to be ready at all times. We started doing watches. Everything just changed. So I just wanted to make sure that I was ready in case, you know, one of the planes needed to be worked on or fixed, or, you know, they needed it for the next mission.
Mm-hmm. Is there a story, a moment that you will always remember from that time, your deployment?
When the other forces started coming in, they started doing, missions. And I remember we were called back in the office, and we were told that there had been casualties and that they were going to be kept in our hangar until they got a flight back to the state. So there was two casualties, and they were in our hangar for a couple of days waiting to be sent back here. And I remember when they were loaded onto the C-130 or one of the Air Force planes. And I can just remember seeing the caskets being, you know, washed out and loaded onto the plane. And I just kept thinking, you know, like, that could be us. But, you know, I still got to be ready. And, it was a scary thought that we might not make it back. Sorry.
No, that's perfectly understandable. Thank you very much for talking about it, a difficult time in your life. You got out of the military Was that an easy transition? 14 years ago, I understand, you got out of the military. What kind of transition was that when you had to accustom yourself to civilian life back in the U.S.?
It was hard transition because after the 2005-2006 deployment, we came back, and a few months later, I was pregnant with my youngest, and I was basically forced out of the Navy. I was told I was getting other than honorable because I was pregnant. And at the time, I was just like in shock because here I was almost 10 years in, and I'm just going to get other than honorable because I was pregnant. So I went and talked to JAG, and JAG, they told me that, you know, they can't do that. So you're entitled to all your benefits. You're entitled to an honorable discharge. So I went back to the command and I told them, I said, I'll get out. I won't fight it. But this is what, you know, JAG told me. So they said, okay, you have 3 days to get out. So it was a really rough transition for me. I only had maybe 2 jumps before the military. The military was all I needed. And when I got out, it was difficult. One day I went to pick up my husband from work. And I remember I wasn't feeling like myself. So I picked him up. And he might have said good morning. But I just felt like this rage inside. And all I could think was like, I need to make it to the VA. I need to make it to the VA. So I went to the VA. And I was diagnosed with PTSD. Mm. And then they said, okay, so have a good day, basically. And I was like, okay, so now what? Like, I don't know what this is. How is this going to help me?
And is that something that you were able to cope with, to get over? Is it something you still struggle with today?
I do struggle still, but it's not like it was back then. The VA has come a long way. They have a lot of classes. I have an amazing support system with my husband and my children. My family, my extended family, like my in-laws, they've all been amazing to me. So that has helped me to be where I'm at right now.
That's wonderful. And those who visit our website to find this interview at iowapublicradio.org/leavingafghanistan on your particular segment here, we can see some of the photos that you shared with us. Photos of you, I see one here, working on jets, receiving awards on a military airfield, on what looks like an aircraft carrier. Do you have a favorite photo that you bring back great memories to you?
So I think my favorite would be there's 2 planes with propellers, because that was after 9/11. The plane that you see is like 3-2 on the left.
Yes, I see it.
That plane had been down for a while. And they needed it like yesterday. And we went from, it was going to take us at least a couple of weeks to get it, you know, ready. We got it ready in 3 days. So that was enough. That was, you know, it was just teamwork. And right. Then they had that extra plane available for missions.
A proud moment for you. That's a nice photo to have. I wanted to ask you a couple of quick questions before we have to end this conversation. What are your thoughts on the U.S. mission overall? 20 years of war and now the withdrawal of all U.S. troops?
So overall, my opinion is we tried. My thoughts on the withdrawal is, you know, it's about time. It's been 20 years is a long time. We've all lost loved ones, friends, you know, during and after their military service. I just think that, you know, we tried for 20 years and, you know, there's still stuff going on over there. So I don't know what it would take, you know, what's going to take for changes to be made or to, you know, significant changes to be made there.
What are your thoughts about the people of Afghanistan and their future? the women, I suppose, especially.
My hope is that they, you know, they do, especially the women, that they, you know, they get a voice and that they can succeed on their own. I met wonderful people when I was there. I didn't have a negative experience with anyone there because I blended in. I don't know if that was the, you know, but they were really nice to us when we were there. There was a bartender. His name was Vincent. We called him Vince. I met him in 98, the first deployment. And then when I went back in 2001, he remembered me. And it was like I had just seen him the day before. Mm. So they were, you know, they were amazing people. I just don't, like, I feel like I can't stand here and just tell them how they should be, you know, because this has been going on more than 20 years. You know, I can't be telling you my way is the right way, and you know.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Well, thank you for sharing so many memories and your deployment in the Afghanistan war, during the war, multiple deployments in the Middle East. Maria Berdicia, a Navy veteran of the Afghanistan war, originally from Texas, now calls Davenport home in the Navy. She worked as an aviation mechanic. And Maria, thank you so much for this conversation and for sharing with us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your time.
I want to remind our listeners, if you served in Afghanistan and would like to share your story, possibly here on Iowa Public Radio, email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Please mention where you grew up in Iowa, where you're living in Iowa, where you were deployed, your branch of the military, those kind of basics, your rank, as well as a memory or two that you'll never forget about your deployment during the Afghanistan war. Coming up after a short break, new COVID cases rising in all 50 states, and our neighbor to the south, Missouri, is a hotspot. After this break, we'll check in with University of Iowa epidemiologist Dr. Melanie Wellington. Back in just a moment, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
This season, Garden Variety wants to help you flourish. Each week, our favorite horticulturists drop by with fresh tips. Subscribe and dig in. Head to ipr.org/garden or find Garden Variety wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, we welcome back infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Dr. Melanie Wellington. Dr. Wellington, so good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
You were last on our program July 2nd, now approximately 3 weeks later. The Delta variant, which we spoke of at that time, is even more of a threat. Want to get your thoughts on where we find ourselves in this pandemic. Want to reach out to listeners this half hour. If you have a question about the infection rate, hospitalizations, and so forth, or the vaccine campaign, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Dr. Wellington, let me quickly set the scene. Where we are, according to the New York Times tracking as of today, July 22nd, case numbers climbing rapidly in the country, well below, though, below peak levels. Hospitalizations, deaths are also increasing, but at a slower pace. New cases rising in all 50 states. We have this Delta variant. Infection levels soaring in parts of the U.S., Louisiana, Florida, Arkansas, and our neighbor to the south, Missouri. If you look at those maps, it's really got some infection rates that are worrying. Vaccines widely available, have been for some time, effective against the Delta variant. but we still have fewer than half Americans fully vaccinated. Let me quote briefly from the New York Times today. 18 months after the coronavirus first emerged, governments in Asia, Europe, and the Americas are encouraging people to return to their daily rhythms and transition to a new normal in which subways, offices, restaurants, and airports are once again full. Increasingly, the mantra is the same. We have to learn to live with the virus. Yet scientists warn that the pandemic exit strategies may be premature. Do you agree with that, Dr. Wellington?
Well, that's a tough question. It is definitely premature to say the outbreak is over. I think we can all agree on that. And I do want to point out that it is the Delta variant that we're seeing that's associated with this infection rise right now. But it's not just rising because of the Delta variant. Infection rates are rising because people who are not vaccinated are getting exposed through behaviors that are causing increased exposures. So we do need to keep our wits about us. We do need to keep our caution in hand. And do we need to open up or not open up or something in between becomes really a local decision. What we all need to keep in mind, though, is the outbreak's not over, and it is a community issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing to say, I'm not at risk, but everybody is at risk, and everybody has someone they care about who's at increased risk. So we need to act as a community to keep our caution, keep our safety measures going, and make sure that anyone who can be vaccinated gets vaccinated, because that's really how we're going to keep cases down.
Right. What do you make of the fact that even more local Republican leaders are pleading with their supporters to get vaccinated? We know that you can look at a map of the U.S., of Iowa, counties that most supported former President Trump in the last election are the ones that are struggling with vaccination rates. So this has to be a good turn. And unusual as it is for epidemiology, the spread of the disease to be tied up with politics, there you have it, right?
Right. I think that it's great that anybody who is a leader and who can be part of a community and lead them towards increased vaccination rates should work as hard as they can, because we really need that right now. Mm. You're absolutely right that there are some trends and politics has been tied up in this pandemic, but we can be better than that. And I think that's what's happening now. And we're all realizing the biology of the vaccine doesn't care about politics at all. We all need to be working towards getting rid of this thing.
Right. And the one fact that should convince the unvaccinated to get vaccinated, I have to believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but almost all hospitalizations and deaths from COVID currently are among the unvaccinated, 99%.
I think the exact number depends on individual hospitals and which patients have which risk factors, but it's absolutely true that you could say almost all of the people who have severe disease, who are being hospitalized or who are dying from COVID, are unvaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then, someone who was vaccinated isn't able to make as strong of a response, and they can be vulnerable to severe disease, but that's very, very unusual.
Mm-hmm. What is the picture for the community you serve there at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City?
Well, I'm a pediatrician at heart, so, and also by training. I think it's important also, as we start thinking through the issues here, we need to remember there is an entire large chunk of our population who cannot yet be vaccinated. If I'm reading the population statistic right, somewhere between 20 and 25% of Iowans are children. And of those children, only children 12 and older can be vaccinated. So All of the kids out there, 0 to 11, can't be vaccinated yet at all. And so the situation that we're looking at right now is, at least in our very, very local area, we have reasonably high vaccination rates, but not everybody is vaccinated. And so what we're seeing is the same thing everybody else is seeing, that the people who are not vaccinated are having a surge in disease, and that the behaviors of everybody as we loosen up our restrictions are causing a surge in children as well.
Okay, let's go to our phones. 1-866-780-9100. Questions you may have for our infectious disease specialist, Dr. Melanie Wellington. Let's go to Elizabeth, calling from Urbandale. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead with Dr. Melanie Wellington.
Yes, thank you. We are about to host a family reunion, families coming from Virginia and from Texas. They are flying, so there's airports. We have a couple of elderly people in the family and one unvaccinated three-year-old. What's the protocol for us all getting together and being safe?
I'm sure your story is repeated in different variations all around the state and the country. Dr. Wellington, what do you have to recommend?
Absolutely, Elizabeth. I actually get this question from our doctors that work here next to me all the time. You're spot on about this being a key point. And before we go into sort of the protocol of how to protect yourselves, I want to emphasize with everyone, there is risk in everything we do, and there is benefit in everything we do. And even in the middle of a pandemic, we have to weigh those benefits and risks. And in Elizabeth's case, her family has really embraced the value and the need in their life to be together as a family. And so I love that you're calling to say, we know this is a benefit that we want to work towards, and how can we decrease that risk? So it's always that balancing act. So I love this question. Well, I don't love it. I wish we didn't need to have it at all. But I think it really is one of the best questions out there. And what you can do is a few simple things can really keep things protected. And one is any event that you can hold outdoors, hold outdoors. If you can't hold it outdoors, if you can hold it in an open space like an open garage or a house with the windows wide open or a tent, anything you can do to keep things as much outdoors as possible or with as much ventilation as possible is going to decrease the risks of transmission.
Mm-hmm.
It's great to hear that most of the people at this event will be vaccinated, and that also is a real key to protecting yourselves. Past that, your next most important thing is masks. It's not time to give up the masks yet. I know we all wish we could, but this is really our second best strategy for protecting each other. The problem with an event like this, of course, is that our culture shares at these events food and drink and all sorts of things that you can't do with a mask on. And so what a lot of people that I know have done have been to sort of make a segregation of areas of the event. So the majority of people at any one time will be in an area where there's no eating and drinking and they have their masks on. And there's another area for eating or drinking where you keep the number of people in that area low so that you can keep the distance between people so that they can eat and they can drink with their mask off, of course, but still have safety measures around them.
Mm. Sounds like some good advice. Elizabeth.
Ask another question?
Yes, quickly. Go ahead.
Well, this was fine for like the family reunion, but this is a group of 12 people who will be sharing a house.
Mm. Okay. Another dimension there.
Yeah, that definitely adds another dimension. It's very difficult, right? A couple things you can still do would be, I think the phrase people use now is lay low before you go. So if you have some time before this event, everybody who's coming should do everything they can to avoid getting exposed out in public. The people who are coming to the event should be extremely careful anytime they're out in public, especially if it's indoors, to always wear their mask. While they're traveling in through the airport and on the plane, they want to keep their mask on all of the time if it's possible. If it's not possible, when they take their mask off, they should distance themselves from other people as much as possible. So the idea being that you have the lowest risk possible that someone's coming to this house with the infection.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Elizabeth. A great question, a great instance. We wish you good luck in your family reunion for households. Wow, okay. We do want to get together. We have to be super careful, as Dr. Wellington just pointed out. Dr. Melanie Wellington, if you just joined us, my guest this half hour, infectious disease specialist, pediatric infectious disease specialist, and the hospital's associate epidemiologist, 1-866-780-9100. Following up on masks wearing, I don't know if you noticed, doctor, but I certainly did. Suddenly this week, after weeks of seeing actually few masks in public, I'm seeing more of them in grocery stores and so forth. Let's say you want to go to see a show. Let's take another venue, different than Elizabeth's. You want to go see a show. What should I consider when I'm thinking of wearing a mask to a theater? Maybe it's an open-air theater, maybe not, hopefully open-air. Or whether I should go at all. Perhaps I'm immune compromised.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you that the best and safest thing to do, of course, is to stay home. But again, we need to live our lives, too. So that's always that balancing act. If you can find a show that is what you're looking for, that is an open-air show, or even one of these ones where there's a shell with a cover but the sides are open, that is your safest bet if you're going to go out. Always the open air is the best. I am really pleased. I agree. I've seen more people wearing their masks out lately, and I'm very reassured by that. If it's going to be an indoor show, then you have to really start thinking, what are my risks? What is the benefit of this show to me? Because anytime you're indoors, there is a chance of being infected. Even people who are vaccinated can be infected.
Mm-hmm.
It's called a breakthrough infection. It does happen. It's very rare. And when it does happen, those people usually do not get into serious trouble with the virus, but that can happen too. So even if you're vaccinated, you are still at some risk from the virus. And so the vaccine doesn't give you a free pass. It does give you a lot of protection, an extremely large amount of protection. I don't want to make it sound like it doesn't work. They work great. But even when you're vaccinated, you still have to sort of be looking at the situation thinking, what's the risk here? Am I willing to take that risk for the benefit of this activity?
Mm-hmm.
So if it's an indoor venue, is it a venue where people have reduced capacity? Have they come up with a way to maintain distance between people? How crowded will it be? Well, are they asking that everybody at the venue be vaccinated? If I'm remembering right, I heard on the news last night that there was a Bruce Springsteen concert where you had to prove that you'd been vaccinated before you could go to the concert. Obviously, that's a unique scenario. We can't do that with every event we do in our lives.
Yeah.
But those are the kind of things you're looking for to think, this is, what kind of safety measures are in place? And is that enough for me? Depends on what your personal level of risk is. And you also hit the nail on the head, too. If you're immunocompromised, if you're on a medicine that might decrease your response to vaccine, even those folks, if they're vaccinated, still have a higher risk than the rest of us.
Let's go to another caller. Jackie is joining us from Sac City. Jackie, welcome to the program from the northwest part of our state.
Thank you. The quick question I had is, I'm vaccinated, and if I should get a breakthrough infection, could I end up with long hauler effects?
Good question, Jackie. Thank you.
So we don't know quite enough about what happens with disease in vaccinated people yet. Thank goodness, actually, right? It means not that many people are getting infected, which is great news. But there are people who do get the full-blown infection. So we presume, we don't have great data on this yet, so I would love to be wrong, but we presume that those people who do get a full infection could develop the long-term post-infection effects, such as that long haul syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Quick questions, as our time is rapidly disappearing here, Dr. Wellington. Concise, brief answers, if you wouldn't mind, so we can get in as many of these as possible. Let's say you've been infected and recovered, but have not been vaccinated. Do you need to be vaccinated, since evidently, probably, you have some immunity from having the COVID-19 disease?
Yes, you should absolutely still get vaccinated. You're going to have more immunity after the vaccine, and you may end up being one of those people who's ultra-protected. But being infected and then getting better is not alone enough to protect you as much as we can protect you, and we want to give everybody the best protection possible.
Mm-hmm. A lot of talk about booster shots. For some of us, it's been many months since we got our second shot, became fully vaccinated. Will we need booster shots? If so, when? This is being debated right now, isn't it?
It is being debated right now. We suspect there will be a booster shot. Remember, at its heart, the coronavirus is a common cold virus, and we all know you can get that over and over again. So we think we'll need a booster shot, but we don't know when or what it will look like.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to make a version of a booster shot? Will it be different than the original, or perhaps a variation of the original that can target the Delta variant, for instance?
It's definitely possible, especially with the mRNA vaccines. They're fairly readily adaptable. But the early data we have on boosters is going to be with the same vaccine, and we want to go with this data where we have data so that we can be sure that it's safe.
Mm-hmm. Some in the scientific community I've read say we will never need boosters. That's still a question to be determined. I wonder, what is the debate like among infectious disease specialists, epidemiologists right now? What's the spectrum, the range of opinions about where we are with the current very successful vaccines and the possibility that their effectiveness could wane as time goes on?
Mm-hmm. The one side says, you know, we always have waning immunity to coronaviruses. We're going to need a booster, period. The other side says, while it's true that you can get the common cold over and over again, you rarely get into trouble with the common cold after you've had it once. Therefore, a booster is not going to be necessary because the single vaccine or the single series of vaccines will protect you from the severe disease. And then there's a third group that points out that while we are having a happy amount of vaccine available in the U.S., that is not the case around the around the world, and we should wait on booster shots until we get the rest of the world vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. And in which camp are you in, if I may ask?
Oh, boy. I suspect that a booster shot will be given. Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
I also think, though, that we need to think about the ethics of doing that, and I would love to see the whole world vaccinated first.
Right. When we look at data, when you look at data as an epidemiologist and infectious disease specialist, tell us, what is the data that is being used to determine in the coming weeks and months whether a booster is needed, the number of antibodies a person still has, the number of breakthrough infections? You mentioned those.
Mm-hmm. The most data that we're able to collect right now is the different drug companies who make the vaccines are going back to people who were in the original trials. So those are people who were vaccinated August, September, October last year, and looking at their immune responses and then giving a booster dose of the same vaccine and looking at their immune responses again. So we're looking at what responses we can measure in the lab. We don't have a perfect number that says if you're at this number, you're fine. So it's all sort of lab-based data at this point. So the conversation of whether or not to do a booster is going to turn out to be very complex and nuanced. But that's how they do it. They look at somebody's immune response, say today. They give them a dose of vaccine. They wait 4 weeks, and they look at their immune response again.
Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be the case that in the future, or would it, that you would go in to see your primary care physician or some other medical professional, they could on the spot see if you need a booster based on antibodies or whatever?
It's not possible right now, and it's not going to be possible in the close future. But the pandemic has certainly mobilized the power of our scientific research community, and I'm not going to say nothing will ever happen because that would be prideful.
Okay. This is a huge moneymaker for pharmaceutical companies, Pfizer specifically. Their vaccine, I read, could soon become the all-time best-selling drug ever, and this in the course of only 1 year. How can we know that Big Pharma won't be able to convince us convince us that, oh, you always need a yearly booster, even when we might not?
I think that there's a nice balance in our country between Big Pharma, academics, and government, and everybody has to be looking at the data, not just at does a booster increase the immune response, but how will it help the population? And the combination of people that are going to need to say, yes, we should be doing this, it should protect us from that conflict of interest of the monetary impact for the company.
Mm-hmm. And back to something you mentioned just a moment ago, the moral ethical debate over whether wealthy countries such as ours should be asking drug companies to ramp up production of boosters when in many poorer countries, there are still very low vaccination rates, places where even elderly people, healthcare workers even, have not yet been vaccinated.
That is definitely an ethical question, but it's also a biological question and one that has impact to our health here in this country. Because the more the virus goes from person to person, the more chances it has to mutate into a new variant that could be even more dangerous. So what's happening in Africa can change our health here very quickly. If we don't immunize everybody around the world, then there's going to be this ongoing transmission, and there will continue to be new variants and new mutants that could be more dangerous.
Okay, thank you very much. We've run out of time. It's gone very quickly. As before, Dr. Melanie Wellington, you've been a wealth of information, Associate Hospital Epidemiologist, Pediatric Infectious Disease Specialist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Thank you for making time for us once again, Dr. Wellington.
Thank you so much for making time for this important topic. I really appreciate it.
Very good. And thank you for the callers, the inputs, great calls. Well, we continue to tackle this pandemic. We'll hope for the best. And with a well-informed public, that bodes well for us, I'm sure.
Iowa Public Radio has the cure for your endless scrolling. The IPR app. The latest news, your favorite music, fresh podcasts, they're all a tap or two away. With newscasts updating throughout the day, the latest stories every time you open the app, and live streams of your go-to station, you get only what you need to know when you need to know it. So stop the scroll. Get the IPR app.
River to River, produced today by Matt Alvarez, our other producers, Rick Brewer, Zachary Oren Smith. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Tomorrow, it's a NewsBuzz edition. Hope you'll tune in for that. I'm Ben Kiefer. Until tomorrow, thank you.